Welcome back to Compliance for the Sake of the Patient. John Mitchell here again with you. Steve Sponbrook is as usual, and all as kind of a new opportunity, our first guest, Gordon Burrell. So I'm going to turn this over to Steve today. Steve, it's going to be a good time. I hope we can keep this under 30 minutes.
Yeah, that's going to be true. I would say celebrity guest, by the way, Gordon Burrell.
Celebrity guest.
Yeah, our first international guest too, Gordon, hailing from Canada.
Right.
Honestly, Gordon's one of my best friends on the planet. I think we're sort of wondering if we were separated at birth somehow, but that's another story for another time. But I wanted Gordon on this call for a couple reasons. One, Gordon has a company up in Canada called TGOR Consulting that does, I mean, he is 100% locked in on construction risk mitigation, particularly with infection prevention in mind. If we read his resume, we would run into a couple of hours. So I don't want to go into all that, but we'll make sure we get that information out there. But Gordon is certainly one of the world's leading experts in construction risk mitigation, particularly with infection prevention. And one of the things that, you know, we've talked about a lot of different things during the first few episodes of this, you know, kind of sized up the problem. We've talked about some strategies in terms of differential pressure and barriers and how to handle materials and people in and out of construction site. But the one thing that we haven't really talked about, and perhaps it's not the most important, but one of the most important, they're all important, is, you know, cleanliness and how to keep your construction site clean. And not only is that important during construction itself, but also well into the future of that site once it's occupied by the organization. So this is particularly important with greenfield new hospitals, you know, coming right out of the ground. So I really wanted Gordon. Gordon's the guy that I call, honestly, when I have questions about stuff. And, you know, we're a little bit late getting this thing put together. I'd hope to have it done before Christmas, and here we are well into March. But unfortunately, we were running in so many different directions, we just couldn't put it together. But thanks to the coronavirus and COVID-19, everybody's at home. So we have the time to do it. We're going to take advantage of that. So, Gordon, I appreciate you taking the time because I know you're really busy and you've been getting a lot of phone calls about, what's going on in the world with this pandemic. But I welcome you to the podcast. Thanks for being here.
Well, thanks for having me, Steve. It's certainly true that you end up in lockdown. We crossed international borders about 10 days ago, so that's put me in my home office for 14 consecutive days, not allowed to go out. So welcome to the modern world of viral transmission.
Yeah, it's quite a transition, isn't it?
It certainly is a different world. One of the things about it, though, I think, is that it has certainly highlighted what the microbial world has the potential to have for an impact on your everyday life and the impact on patients in hospitals. We've seen hospitals right across the world struggling to try to deal with a new bug, but they've always been trying to deal with bugs all along, and they're always challenging in that they're not visible to us. We can't see what we're up against, so it's a bit of a challenge to fight that.
Yeah, one of the interesting things that popped up on my newsfeed this morning, and I haven't had time to really go in and verify that there's more than one source collaborating this, because I never make a decision based on one source. But I read a quick article about they had identified the coronavirus, this particular strain, could live for 17 days on the cruise ship that they're monitoring on surfaces, which is phenomenal length of time. And it kind of plays into what we're talking about in terms of cleanliness and construction sites. And one of the things that you guys do, and always the reason you're the person that I call, and I think it's safe to say that the bar in Canada is 3 or 4 notches higher than the bar typically south of the border for cleanliness and really everything related to infection prevention. And that's one of the reasons we really like to pick your brain when we can. But, you know, just to kind of give us an idea, you know, what is your minimum expectation that a contractor is going to do during, and let's first talk about renovation, because I know you're probably going to have slightly different, but maybe not totally different expectations with a greenfield project, but in a renovation project, in terms of cleanliness on the construction site, when you walk in the door, what do you expect to see?
Well, it certainly varies by site and what kind of project you're working on and where you're at in the hospital. And I understand on previous versions of of these podcasts, you've talked about creating the barriers and differential pressure around various work sites. If you're in an administrative area, the level of cleanliness on those renovation projects would not be a whole lot different. It would probably be a little bit different and a little bit higher than you might expect if you were doing a renovation in an office building, but it wouldn't necessarily be notably different than that within the construction zone itself. Certainly outside of the construction zone and the access routes for the workers, it would be different. And as you move through the hospital and into the different depths of risk areas, move up to, say, intensive care units or operating room suites and those types of things, it would not be unusual for a construction project in a high-risk area to be maintaining day-to-day cleanliness comparable to the operating part of the hospital itself. So we imagine a renovation or a refit within an operating room, and if especially if the workers have to transition through, say, a substerile corridor or something along those lines, the expectation is that there would be no impact on the cleanliness in the ORs at all. And by no impact, I mean zero impact, not a minimal impact or a little bit of impact. I mean no impact. You would not know that the construction was actually happening within the OR suite. There'd be a wall up. That wall would be a completed barrier wall. It would have a finished surface that's going to be wipeable on that outside in case there's any problems in the ORs. But on the once you transition into the construction zone, it's still going to seem very much like a hospital clean space. And that's not easy to do in a construction area. That takes a culture, a commitment to a cleanliness culture by the contractors to be able to do that. Now, not every building is at that level, but certainly those that are pushing the envelope on cleanliness in construction areas are. They're recognizing that hospitals and hospital construction today has the potential to have an impact on patients through the life of the building. Fungal spores and bacterial spores have the potential to live at least many, many years in the spore state. And there'd be some argument within scientific circles as to whether that's decades or centuries. Regardless, the impact on immunocompromised and immunosuppressed patients in a subsequent renovation project can be life-threatening. So our construction industry has really come to the recognition of the fact that the work they do today can save lives years from now when more work is happening in those buildings. And our more advanced construction team members are creating those environments where, in essence, they're working at a construction grade clean that's almost the same as a hospital grade.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned culture. And one of the things we've been kind of talking through in each one of these episodes is how important it is for everyone on that job site to understand why these requirements are the way they are and what the expectation is and what is the result if they fail to do what they need to do to protect the patients. And so the whole start with why, the Simon Sinek thing, has been an integral part through this whole series of podcasts. But I think without that culture, you're almost doomed to fail, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think the sites that we see that are very successful are those that create a culture. And it's not a top-down culture. It's not telling people what to do, because people don't always do what you tell them to do. And when you're not there, you're not looking at them. It's helping them to understand why, as you've mentioned, and getting them into a position where they understand the full magnitude of the impact of the work that they're doing. It's not sticks and bricks that they're working on. If they're a mechanical contractor, they're not just knocking on sheet metal to get ductwork in place. They're actually working within a space where their action or inaction can kill patients. And once that message is there and the culture is there, there's a bit of a tipping point that occurs. And I've seen sites that struggle to maintain construction cleanliness. They haven't quite yet attained that tipping point. And then those that cross the tipping point, once you cross the tipping point, it's no longer a in a situation where site supers have to kind of enforce it and continually reinforce the message and all of that type of stuff, it becomes the individuals within the culture that make that happen. And, you know, I would liken it, I travel a fair little bit, and you get a rental car in a city that you're not used to, and you get out on the freeway, and I gauge what's happening with the other drivers that are around me. And in some cities, they'll be at the speed limit, and in some cases, actually below the speed limit. Other cities, they'll be well over the speed limit. That's a cultural indication to me. It shows that in this environment, it's acceptable to be at, you know, whatever that speed might happen to be, 75 or 80 miles an hour on the freeway, or maybe it's 60 miles an hour on the freeway, totally dependent on the space that you're in. The culture is driving that. And I adhere to that culture because I see the behavior and I tend to follow that behavior. So if you've got that kind of environment in a construction site, new employees coming to work, new tradespeople coming onto the site, they see the behavior and they'll start to emulate that behavior because the culture drives them, not because they made a conscious decision, not because their boss has told them so. It's totally subconscious within the culture to continue in that methodology.
Absolutely. Sorry, my doorbell rang in the middle of that. hopefully that was Amazon bringing toilet paper, by the way. But
that's the advantage of working at home, right?
Yeah, it's the advantage of working at home and the disadvantage. I think if anything, this pandemic has shown, and maybe the timing of this episode is perfect, because it's this invisible enemy that, you know, we've been trying for years to say, hey, it's not. It's only a little bit of dust. I've heard that a few times. Well, only a little bit of dust can be catastrophic.
Yeah, you hear that a lot.
Yeah.
And what's the big deal? It's just one footprint outside the construction site. Come on, lighten up a little bit.
Right. And the other thing, you know, we'll flip this discussion a little bit and talk about Greenfield, because I literally had a builder not long ago in a hospital say, hey, we're building a brand new hospital out in the middle of nowhere. We don't have to worry about doing an infection control plan, do we? Like, duh. Yeah,
that's an interesting. It's been an interesting journey on the new construction side of the house, in the Canadian marketplace, and it certainly did. It's different everywhere, and I don't mean to, sort of impose any one jurisdiction over another, but in the Canadian marketplace, a standard that we use here was developed first in 2003. Was the first edition. And we got exactly the kind of feedback that you were talking about. While it's a new hospital, we don't have to worry about it. We're not inside the existing walls of the existing building. And the folks that put that document together saw light to say, well, it does matter, and it matters enough that they put a separate chapter specifically within that document to deal with new construction. And it's all about what we do today that creates the legacy that's left behind for the patients that come in that are dealing with cancer or leukemia or diabetes or whatever their condition might be, 5 or 10 or 15 years from now. And if you put that in the context and you think about, guys, old guys like me that are getting towards the end of our careers, we could be that patient.
Oh, yeah.
So what I do today could impact my ability to receive good care in 10 years' time. And all of a sudden, I get a little bit more passionate about doing it properly when I think, it could be me in the bed.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that's something we don't do a really good job of explaining, particularly to people who can really make a difference here. And that's the folks that are doing the actual work in the field, you know, and those that are responsible, particularly for cleaning up after those that are doing, you know, the trades that are doing their thing. And I think it's important, too, to point out that, I mean, you guys sort of were the forefront here and doing, it was the 25-year study that was published back in 2001, correct?
That's correct, yeah.
Yeah, so, and for those of you that are listening that are wondering what we're talking about, there was a Canadian study that was done over a 25-year period, peer-reviewed. I can't remember the total number of cases. I guarantee Gordon does, like 357?
347.
Oh, it's one number off. Gee.
Yeah.
Those were
outbreaks. 347 outbreaks.
347 outbreaks, but it's a 58-page PDF that's Google Canadian 25-year study construction infection or whatever. It'll pop right up. And some of the stuff that the stories or cases that are reviewed in there, the projects are pretty small.
Yeah, incredibly simple. Some of them were just as simple as maintenance workers that were taking down old blinds out of a window, putting a new blind up in that place. Or one in that document that I remember very clearly was a maintenance worker that needed to get access into the ceiling at the nurse's station in the intensive care unit where patients were lost. And the big one that strikes me because it's so reminiscent of a hospital project that I worked on almost 30 years ago now, was the construction wasn't even in the hospital. It was highway construction or freeway construction that was happening near to the hospital, and the fungal spores were drawn in through air handling systems into the building where 7 patients were killed.
Yeah.
And when you start to see the advantage of that particular study is it starts to show you that the invisible chain. And, you know, we've been involved in a couple of investigations where patients have either been irreversibly harmed or killed, where the chain of connection of the fungus or the bacteria to the patient seems almost incomprehensible. You'd look at it and you say, well, there's just no chance in the world that it could ever possibly happen.
Yeah,
and yet it does.
Yeah. I was about to relate the story of when we were working together and the culprit was a failed building envelope and a negative room that probably should have been positive and a patient that should have definitely been in a positive room. And an excavation going on outside, once that came to the light of day, there were a lot of people who were wishing they'd made some different decisions.
Well, I mean, it's not the only time where something along those lines has happened. We've been involved in investigations of roofing replacement projects where the roofing membranes have failed. Otherwise, you wouldn't be replacing a roof. The roofing membranes have failed, and there's been moisture migration into the insulation on the underside of the roofing, and general contractor, roofing contractor comes along, rips the old roofing materials off, aerosolizes many of those moisture droplets that are in the wet insulation, only to have those get drawn into very high moving fans with air handling units and then distributed into the building. We've got great filtration systems in lots of places in the hospital, but the filters aren't always the types of filters that you would need to stop the transmission of either fungal or bacterial spores into the building. So they'll get the larger particulate, and it almost becomes even a subsequent challenge in that because the filters remove the particulate that's visible to the eye, there's a perceived comfort within the building that there's no problems. And yet this invisible animal is moving around within the building. And that's exactly what we're seeing with COVID-19, right? With that virus, the biggest concern is the invisible movement. It's the community transmission by those who are non-symptomatic that are moving the virus from one person to another until it reaches a susceptible host, and then all of a sudden somebody's getting very sick.
Yeah, it's been interesting. There's been a lot of discussions about, you know, why we work at the hospitals, and when we're talking about the hospitals at this point, it's kind of worldwide. We're not better prepared to deal with this. And it kind of goes back to one of our favorite sayings is that Frank Borman from Apollo 1's investigation said to Congress so many years ago, it's a failure of imagination. I mean, we've been planning for pandemics for decades, but, you know, who could have predicted that anything like this was going to happen or really be able to rationalize this? And, it's true, I think, in all aspects. And we look at like just the stories we just related in terms of, you know, removing the blinds was a big deal, you know, unfiltered air coming through a failed building envelope, you know, having the ability to sit down and think through these things and really open your mind to all the possibilities and all the pathways. And I don't want to tell people to be pessimistic, but you really got to have somewhat of a perspective of bad things are going to happen if I don't figure out a way to prevent them. What are they? Does that make sense?
I think that makes a lot of sense. And I think the other challenge there is to always be thinking along the lines of what am I currently doing and what risk does this currently create? And when it comes back to, you know, cleanliness on the construction sites, I think that's a question that everybody needs to ask. Unfortunately, I think some of the times we sort of think of that cleaning up a construction site as the necessity that you got to do it. So let's do it on Friday afternoon before everybody goes home, and then everybody will be happy. As opposed to the fact that continuous maintenance of the cleanliness on the construction site as being an ongoing protection mechanism, not only for the folks that are in the hospitals, but potentially for the folks who are working in construction areas as well.
Right.
Cleaner sites are safer sites, right?
Absolutely. I don't want to minimize the other types of pathogens, but airborne, particularly fungal, is what we're predominantly concerned with, right?
Yeah, I think the biggest issue around construction sites, the fungal infections are, they would account for in the range of 80% plus of infections in immunocompromised patients that are sourced to construction areas.
Yeah. So if you're a Pareto fan, that's where you'd want to put your money.
Well, exactly. If you're looking at trying to say where do I put my money that I'm going to get the biggest bang for the buck, it's going to be stopping the air movement from the construction site and stopping the dust generation from aerosolizing and traveling outside of that renovation space, or from an expansion to a hospital being drawn into the existing building like you talked about, or from new construction being deposited into the building, into the infrastructure, so that it's now there in a dormant state to be re-energized at some point in the future.
Yeah, and I think it at least I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, but maybe I am. I apologize if that's true. But if they're thinking of cleanliness as being a checklist item at the end of the day, or it's a single point in time, maybe it's daily, maybe it's twice a day, then the rest of the period while they're working, that fungal load, that airborne contaminant load is getting higher and higher and higher, and therefore the risks are going up.
I think you're bang on the money. I would look at it the same as you look at construction safety, right? Does construction safety only exist when the safety officer is doing their tour through the site? And if that's the case, you have an unsafe site. If the thought process of cleanliness is only at the times when we're doing the cleanup, then you have an unclean site. You have a site that's generating unnecessary risks for the occupants within the building. Again, it really boils back to that culture piece, right? It's culture is continuous, is pervasive. It's in the minds of everybody that's in the space without them necessarily thinking about it consciously. It's a subconscious element. And once you reach that stage where you've got the subconscious cultural involvement on the site where everybody sees the problem, right? If you've got a laborer on a construction site that sees somebody on a lift that's not tied off with the proper fall arrest equipment, they're going to say something about it because they're concerned about their coworker's safety. If we can reach that stage with construction cleanliness where somebody sees that the cleanliness is not being maintained, and they're comfortable to say something to positions of authority because they're concerned about the safety of the patients or the folks who are on the other side of the barrier wall or their friends or their family or them coming back into the building 10 years from now, that's when we've been successful.
Right. And, this is not an insignificant problem, right? We estimate about 14 patients die every day due to construction-related infections or maintenance-related. Basically the same thing. In the bigger picture with what's going on around the world right now, those numbers might seem small, but it's our hope and prayer that this coronavirus thing is going to be somewhat contained in a box of time, whether that's 2 months or 3 months or less, hopefully, but whatever it is, this has been going on for quite a while. So over the span of however long we've been doing construction, we've been keeping data, that adds up to a lot of patients that otherwise might have had a different outcome. And that's deaths. I mean, that's not how many patients have been impacted with fungal infections, which were not a pleasant experience for anybody, that, you know, managed to survive that, don't get counted in the statistics. So kind of getting back, one other question I want to ask, because it's something we get a lot, is, you know, what about food and drinking and all that stuff, you know, sodas and Gatorades and other, you know, energy drinks and all that stuff. You know, how do you guys handle that? And what would your recommendations be?
Well, certainly any of the projects that we're working on, you wouldn't see any of that. That's all completely restricted to spaces that have been built for that purpose, whether they be, you know, construction trailers. If it's a large construction project, it would be maintained in the construction trailers or in a designated lunchroom that has ongoing cleanups happening within that space over the lunch hour and so on. The, in Canada, one of the strongest addictions that we have is our addiction to Tim Hortons coffee. And when we first started to introduce the fact that you couldn't have your Timmies when you were out on construction sites, we had a lot of the workforce that became pretty agitated by that. But I think for the most part now, they've come to the realization, they understand why that's not there. In major construction projects with the larger reputable construction contractors, pretty much coast to coast now, would be water for hydration available through hydration stations throughout construction sites, but no food or drink other than that anywhere within the working area.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the key to that's, again, explaining to everybody why that's really important. You know, I had this conversation recently, and I said, you know, if we just put a sign up and say, tell them, you know, no food or drinks on the construction site, we're just jerks.
That's right.
You know, but if we explain why, more than likely, I'm still convinced the numbers were north of 99% of the people are going to comply because they understand, hey, what I'm doing now, like you said, can impact not only me, but everybody involved in this healthcare organization well in the future.
Yeah, I'm absolutely a firm believer that most of the people that are coming to work on our construction projects, especially those that are working on hospital construction projects, are coming to work with the intention of trying to do a good job. And the reason that mistakes get made are because they don't know. That there is that odd worker that doesn't care. And quite frankly, as far as I'm concerned, we need to get rid of those folks.
Oh, yeah.
But they're few and far between. And most contractors understand that if they've got somebody that doesn't care about whatever it is that they're doing, whether it's the safety protocols or it's the cleanliness protocols or it's the infection control protocols, they know that it's not a good match, that the individuals should not be in the healthcare construction business, and they'll find ways to move those people off the sites. The folks who don't care, don't know, and create some of these situations, and I've been in a couple of these, and I'm sure you probably have as well, Steve, where an investigation of a negative patient outcome has highlighted that somebody's action, and usually it's a combination of events, but somebody's action has contributed to a patient dying or being irreversibly harmed, is absolutely devastating. And I don't care how tough the construction workers are, it's still devastating. Nobody wants to hurt another human being if they can avoid it.
Yeah, it's life-changing. You know, it's not something that, you know, it's not like a headache that goes away when you take a couple of Tylenol.
No, it takes forever.
Yeah, and that's, you know, we've unfortunately, you know, because of our experience, we've been involved in a few of those where we've had to look across the table and not point the finger, but, you know.
No, just highlight the chain of events.
Yeah.
You know, the light bulb goes on. Usually the individuals who have made one of those mistakes that are in the chain all of a sudden begin to realize that something they had done unknowingly, totally not wanting to harm anybody.
Right.
But something that they had done had contributed, even if it wasn't the root cause, but it was still a contributing factor to one of these situations. It is life-changing. It's such that they can't forget it. And of course, their whole outlook on working on construction projects become totally different. It's no different than individuals who've been involved with safety accidents on construction sites. And, you know, we've been involved in the past. We've worked on construction projects where there have been safety accidents on the construction site. Maybe nowhere near where you're working, nothing to do with what you're doing. But you still feel horrible having been on a site where somebody was hurt. Even though it was totally out of your control, you had no application to it whatsoever, you still feel bad. I mean, I've had a few of those, and I can clearly tell you in very vivid detail each of the events and what I was doing on the site at those times. They're markers in your career that you just can't lose track of.
And I've used this analogy a few times, but I always describe these events as if you've ever played the game Jenga, you know, and it gets to that point where the Jenga tower, no matter which block you pull, a thing's coming down. You know, it's every one of these investigations, there's been like a Jenga tower or things, you know, just one. There's one decision that had been a little bit different, or one, you know, situation had been changed, then the outcome would have been different. And it's rarely is it, you know, there's one specific item that you go, this is exactly what did everything, right?
I absolutely agree. You know, I don't think we've ever done an investigation where there has been a singular cause.
Yeah, and I think that to me highlights, again, you know, imagining the risk. And I hate to keep going back to that failure of imagination, but if we ever want to get to zero, and I'm pretty sure I started this series off with a statement about, you know, I believe, and I know you, Gordon, you believe as well, because we've talked about this on many, many occasions. Our conversations are kind of boring, aren't they? that construction and maintenance-related infections are absolutely 100% preventable.
Absolutely.
100%. You know, there are thousands of other infections that happen in healthcare organizations that kind of fall out of our area of expertise, if you will, that maybe... you know, maybe we'll never get to zero on those, but there was literally no reason and no excuse why we can't get to zero on construction maintenance related infections today.
Well, and I agree with that 100%. Yeah, I mean, it's very easy to look around and say, well, what about this or what about that? But I look at it from the perspective of what is within my zone of influence. What can I do to make this site better? And you know, my zone of influence on construction sites is relatively small. I don't work for the contractor. Well, I do. I'm contracted to contractors from time to time, but ultimately, generally, have no authority on the site. All I can do is offer advice and provide some insight into some of the challenges. But when you think about whatever your job is, whether your job is the mechanic that's installing the ductwork or doing the electrical conduit installation, or you're responsible for the installation of the air handlers, or you're the laborer that's sweeping the floor, we all have areas where we have an ability to make change. We all have areas within our zone of influence, regardless of what our job is, that we can have a degree of influence. And if the culture on the construction site supports all players to exercise that ability to influence the things that they're doing, then you end up with a much safer construction zone.
Yeah, what you're talking about is culture of safety.
Yep.
Yeah.
And safety beyond construction safety, but from a patient safety, infection control safety perspective.
Absolutely. Well, I tell you, Gordon, this time goes by really quickly, if you might have noticed. And I really wanted to get into some discussion with you about monitoring, because, again, you're my go-to guy on monitoring. There are so many different ways to do it. There's pitfalls, and there's, you know, good and bad and all of that stuff. And I don't want to put you on the spot, but hopefully we'll get to pick your brain for another episode, and we'll just I can't talk all of a sudden. We'll dedicate that time to you know, what kinds of things should you look at to make sure that, you know, your barriers are working, your differential pressures work, and your cleanliness, all those things are working together so we get to that zero harm patient level, because we can do that. And the monitoring piece is absolutely critical. And from my perspective, you know, I'm a contractor that's listening to this right now. You know, I'm going to be a little bit worried about if I get this wrong, I'm going to get sued. I hate to get it down, bring it down to a litigation level, but without a good and effective monitoring plan and documentation, you might as well just open the checkbook because you're going to lose, you know? So I'd really love to have you back, talk about that sometime here in the future. And I just want to thank you for your time and your friendship and your great advice here. And John, it's, I think we can go ahead and wrap this one up.
All right. Well, I got to say, out of all the years I've known you guys, I've never known you to speak for 30 minutes without mentioning hockey.
Because the NHL is suspended right now. And we're both depressed about it, John.
I know you are.
Well, Gordon, thanks. That was awesome. I sure hope we get to hear you back here pretty soon. And I really appreciate you being on today. And man, if you're listening out there right now, please keep listening, keep paying attention to every single decision you make. You can hear today the implications, and cleanliness is becoming a major part of our culture at this point, and I think that's a good thing. So guys, thanks again, and thank you today for listening to Compliance for the Sake of the Patient. We'll see you next time.